Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast, covering emerging topics and challenges in the fields of probiotics, prebiotics, synbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. This is the podcast of the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, known as ISAP, a nonprofit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of these fields. Check us out at www.isapscience.org. I'm Dr. Mary Ellen Sanders, ISAP's Executive Science Officer. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest is Michael Cabana, who's Professor of Pediatrics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx in New York. And Michael, you're very, very welcome. And thank you for joining us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
And you're a pediatrician, right? We said that in the intro.
Yeah. So I've been a practicing pediatrician for the last 25 years, and I've done some clinical trials with probiotics and prebiotics. And as chair of the Department of Pediatrics here at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, we have a large portfolio of clinical trials. So that's one of the things that we do here. It's not just taking care of kids, but also making sure that in the future we have new therapies for kids so that we keep evolving and moving forward.
And do you have a specialization within pediatrics?
Well, I'm trained as a general pediatrician. I did some additional training in public health and epidemiology. I am serving as a member of the United States Preventive Services Task Force. Have an interest in public health prevention and the use of evidence-based medicine.
And that's very prestigious to be a member of that task force. You began your career, conducting very rigorous trials at UCSF. Can you tell us about how you got interested in probiotics for taking care of your patients as a potential intervention worth studying?
Sure. So my first studies were about asthma. And, as you know, asthma is a chronic condition. And as a general pediatrician, I thought, well, it'd be nice if there was something that parents could do to prevent the development of asthma. At that time, studies were coming out in Finland about the use of probiotics for the prevention of eczema. And eczema, or atopic dermatitis, is a precursor or is associated as an early marker of asthma. So that was one of the areas that we explored. So we were fortunate enough to put together a team and obtain funding. So the first studies was through the focus on asthma and trying to prevent asthma. So that's how I first got into probiotic clinical trials.
And as a clinician and a scientist, I mean, what impresses you most about coming around to recommending, say, to a patient or to a family that they take probiotics? Is it the evidence from RCTs and things? Is it deep insights into the mechanism? I mean, what is it that really makes you think this is a winner for me?
Yeah. So, in the front line in clinics, you're getting questions from parents. The part that gets me interested is just this gap between the demand for probiotics and then the evidence behind it. So closing that gap, I think, is really important. I was just looking up earlier today from MarketWatch about the probiotic market. 2018, the market just for kids and infants is 119 million. It's projected in 2026. So in a few years, $215 million. That's just for kids and infants in the probiotic market. So that's an 8% increase. So increasing demand. At the same time, we really have a lag in terms of the clinical trials that support the use of probiotics. And it's really important to close that gap. When we look at pediatric medicines that we commonly used, about 27% or one in four of the medications we use for kids actually don't have an FDA listing. So we're using adult evidence to extrapolate the use of these medications for kids. And it's even worse for probiotics and prebiotics because the evidence just isn't there in terms of the gap.
Yeah. Now, can you educate our listeners a little bit, Michael, about how evidence works and how, people have access to interventions that may not have evidence, and there's sort of differences between a lack of evidence and proof that something does or doesn't work?
Yeah. So a couple things there. The gold standard for seeing if something works in clinical medicine is the randomized double-blind controlled trial. And that's what we use. And it's not just one trial. So you want multiple trials with different populations in different settings to kind of verify those results. So you really want at least two clinical trials. And that's where the gap is. If you run a search with probiotic health and adult in the National Library of Medicine, just clinical trials and randomized controlled trials for adults, 693 trials. If you do the same search for kids, only 306 studies. If you get really specific for, say, trials for inflammatory bowel disease, which is a common use for probiotics for adults, 16 clinical trials. For kids, only 2 clinical trials. So there's this gap in evidence, and the gap is even worse with kids. So as a pediatrician, as someone who works in an academic health center, closing that gap is really important. So we need more rigorous studies to help guide consumers, help guide practitioners, help guide public health officials about the best way to use these interventions.
Is some of that disconnect because a lot of probiotics and prebiotics are, you know, marketed as supplements and almost as foods, not as pharma. And so can you demand the same level of evidence for supplement or a food, or should we be demanding the same level of evidence as you would for small molecule in pharmaceutical industry, for example?
Yeah, as a clinician, I think that we should be offering evidence-based treatments for our patients at the very least, because the Hippocratic Oath says first do no harm. So we should at least make sure they're safe. So, you know, I think that's definitely being met. But I think the issue here is the evidence really supporting the use of these interventions for kids. So I think that's important. I think whether it's a supplement or whether it's a medication, even if it's a counseling therapy, I think there should be evidence for recommending, you know, the advice we give to parents about, say, putting your kid to sleep or feeding your child. So even if it's counseling, a supplement or a medication, same level of evidence for me is really important.
Yeah, but it's really hard for you wonderful pediatricians to get that kind of evidence. So can you talk to us about, you know, the demographic challenges of studying a chronic disease like asthma in children, and sort of there's demographic determinants of risk, and like, what was your primary outcome and how much follow-up did you require in order to get some insight into whether or not the probiotics are going to prevent the markers of asthma?
Yeah, so I don't think, so Dan and Colin, I don't think it's because folks don't care about kids or folks think evidence is important for kids. It's just that it's naturally going to be harder. So there's some about kids that make conducting clinical trials that much more challenging. And for me, you know, that's the fun part about being a pediatrician who's interested in clinical trials. So it's really a challenge and an opportunity. So Chris Forrest in 1997 described what makes child health research different than adult research. And the nice thing is I'm a guy that likes mnemonics. They all start with the letter D. So when you do trials with kids, there's issues with dependency. So kids are dependent on on adults. There's issues with development, another D. There's delayed payoff. So it takes a while to get to becoming an adult, and kids are going through development. So there's that delayed payoff. There's a different epidemiology, a little bit of a stretch there with that D, which is what you mentioned, Dan. And demographic patterns are different for kids. So if you look at a cross-section of kids versus a cross-section of adults, different demographics, which means that you're going to have to run clinical trials differently. So each one of those issues, dependency, development, delayed payoff, differential epidemiology, the demographic patterns being different, all makes clinical trials for kids that much more challenging, but also that much more exciting when you finish a clinical trial.
Well, what did you have as like your outcome? How long was the follow-up? Because I've done studies of asthma in children and, you know, it's just really challenging. You know, the participants move and there's so many determinants of asthma. So even when we would install interventions in the home to filter the air, the mere fact that we're in the child's bedroom and cleaning the surfaces and things like that, that's going to have an impact on outcomes. So what was your outcome and how long did you have the follow-up?
Yeah, so this goes to the issue of this delayed payoff. So there's really a lot of risk in doing these trials, but potentially a great reward. So we know that the roots of adult diseases, a lot of adult diseases are actually in childhood. Perhaps there's something we can do to prevent these adult diseases if we intervene early enough in kids. So the trial of infant probiotic supplementation tips, which was funded by the National Institutes of Health, we wanted to see if we could prevent asthma. Here's the thing though, to really diagnose asthma, to get an objective measure, to do a pulmonary function test, kids have to be 6, maybe 9 years of age. Typical NIH study is 5 years. So what you're stuck with are some intermediate outcomes. So we used eczema and we also used wheezing. So the problem is a lot of kids wheeze early on in life and they don't necessarily develop asthma. So there's that issue with delayed payoff. You've got a study and, you know, you're recruiting these kids before they're born. So you're waiting 6, 7, 8, 9 years. That's a 10-year study right there. And that's getting all the patients you need in the first year. So big delayed payoff, big time horizon, but you know, potentially a lot of reward if you can find something that works early on. But that just adds up in terms of the millions of dollars to do that type of study. So I think that's what you're pointing to. So we have to rely on these intermediate outcomes, which are not as satisfying as really diagnosing the disease.
And if you as a practicing clinician were to look at the plethora of probiotics that are available, I mean, even just restricting to the commercially available ones, what would you use as your kind of guidelines for selecting the probiotics with the best possible chance of working in a specific condition? Or do you think that a probiotic is a probiotic is a probiotic, and it doesn't really matter which strain or combination of strains you're using?
Yeah, I like to make sure there's at least a couple clinical trials that back it up. So, and in general, the effects, I believe, are strain specific. So a great example of that is colic. So 10 years ago, if we had this podcast and talked about colic, maybe one or two studies, which were not successful, but just in the last 10 years, there's been this growing evidence that a specific strain of a probiotic, L. reuteri, DSM-1793983, I might have the numbers reversed there, but that specific strain for clinical trials showed that it has a great effect in terms of reducing crying time. That's great to see, and that gives me a lot of confidence that, that'll work. You know, on the other hand, there's one study that shows that it wasn't effective. And, you know, Colin, sometimes that one study that doesn't show what you expected, that's the one that gives you a lot of insight. So in analyzing that study, it can tell you when it's not applicable, and that gives you a lot of insight too. So I call them positive studies and then negative studies. Even the negative studies are really useful, but that's an example where the body of evidence has built up nicely. For prevention of necrotizing enterocolitis, really interesting literature there. This is a devastating complication that can occur in premature infants. The problem with the literature there is there's a lot of different interventions with a lot of different probiotics, and they all seem to have positive results to varying degrees. So perhaps, you know, looking at the entirety of the literature, maybe there's a non-specific effect that's causing this protective effect. So that's another way where it's challenging to interpret those studies. These are expensive studies. So putting them all together and understanding the mechanism of action is going to be helpful to guide us out of that. But you really want multiple studies as a clinician, I think, to guide your choice of a probiotic.
So those are two great examples, Michael, and let's talk a little bit about both of them. So with necrotizing enterocolitis evidence, what you mean by there's lots of different positive studies, but it's hard to pick a specific strain because the effects may be non-specific, but it's also, there aren't a lot of studies for any particular strain. And so it kind of makes it hard to satisfy that rule that you like to have multiple clinical trials supporting a particular intervention.
Yeah. So Dan, in the end, you're going to have to, well, at least recently, you'd have to put pen to paper on right. The prescription pad. Now you type it out on the electronic medical record, but at some point you have to give a specific strain with a specific dose with a specific regimen. And it helps to have multiple studies that confirm that a specific strain works. Some of the other criteria that I like to use, if it's done in different settings, that really gives me confidence. If there's what's called a dose response, if you give more, you get a better effect. Or if there's some sort of threshold, that's really helpful to see. So that tells me that works. And if there's a specific mechanism that underlies it, the biologic plausibility. So that's another one of the criteria that I like to use. So strong evidence that's reproducible, dose response, good biologic mechanism. Those are the things that help guide making that decision. But in the end, you need a specific dose. So Although the literature is plentiful for necrotizing enterocolitis, it helps when there's a consensus on a specific strain to use.
Yeah, now let's talk about Lactobacillus reuteri DSM-17938 and the evidence for it with colic. The way you describe how you looked at that evidence, you don't really fully capture the brilliant insight you had. Hey, we should take the data from these trials and analyze them to try to understand why were there so many positive results and yet there was one study with the negative results.
Yeah, this is one of the most satisfying parts of professionally in terms of what's happened. So this shows the importance of standardization. It shows the importance of international collaboration. And it shows that we should treat any clinical trial that's done in kids with a lot of respect and try and utilize as much of the information as possible. So you have a situation where you've got a handful of clinical trials that are really expensive. And because so few kids might get a certain outcome, it's really helpful to be able to combine them. So that's where international scientific organizations really make a difference. It was because of the International Scientific Association of Probiotics and Prebiotics, the meeting in Aberdeen, that everyone got together to say, well, we've got all these trials. We use the same product. We use the same outcome. We use the same criteria. We all collected the same data. We can make this a lot more powerful by combining the data. So because things were standardized, because there was a lot of cooperation, and we were able to find somebody to reanalyze the data individually, it was a much more study. So we were able to learn a lot more from combining studies, and we found that L-reuteri is useful for colic. However, we did find holes in the literature where the one study that wasn't successful in Australia, we'll call that a negative study or a study that showed no difference. Those kids tended to be a little bit older. Those kids tended to be exposed to other medications like proton pump inhibitors that might have affected the microbiota. And I believe those kids tended to also have, there was a greater chance that they might have had formula. So when you analyze that individually, now we have a lot of information that's helpful for clinicians. We know that this is helpful, but you got to start using it by a certain age. It's another reason to continue breastfeeding if at all possible. And it's also another reason not to muck with your microbiota, because if you're using proton pump inhibitors or H2 blockers, it's going to change the acidity of the stomach, and that might be affecting the effectiveness.
Yes. And I was one of the statisticians, as you know, Michael, that was able to reanalyze that data using that methodology called an individual patient data meta-analysis, which is really the best way to take advantage of data for multiple trials, but it requires a diplomat like you that can convince other trialists to provide the data so that we can reanalyze it. And what we found was that in Australia, in fact, the intervention was just as effective with the breastfed children as it had been in Europe, where all of the kids basically were breastfed. And that makes sense biologically. The strain kind of benefits from the breast milk sugars. The formula fed infants is where there was a disconnect. And that's the Australian study allowed many more formula. They basically had formula fed kids in their inclusion criteria, where the European studies basically didn't have it. So it really came down to a really nice story that all around the world, this probiotic was in fact effective in reducing the symptoms of colic for the kids that were breastfed, but there was not much evidence for the kids who were formula fed.
So Dan and Colin, this is what really, it's common in our institution to have a journal club, and yeah. You know, we'll Monday morning quarterback a study and say, well, we should have done this, or we should have done that, or they should have done this, they should have done that. And, you know, somebody will say, well, they should just redo the study. And, you know, that's millions of dollars. Yeah. So as a U.S. taxpayer, we should make the best use of these trials. And, you know, that's the other thing with pediatrics. You know, you have a lot of adults that have common chronic diseases, but it's really hard to find kids with these conditions. So no one study can capture that. No one center can do this. There's a study going on with Lactobacillus paracasei for children with familial hypercholesterolemia. That's 1 in 400 kids. Inflammatory bowel disease, 1 in 1,000 kids. Cerebral palsy with chronic constipation, another L-reuteri study, that's 2 in 1,000 kids. So you really need to be sensitive to the fact that, thank goodness, a lot of kids are generally healthy, but for any one center to be able to do the big, large study, it's just not going to happen. So we have to do a better job of standardizing the way we collect information so it can be combined and put together in endeavors like that. So I think
you have an interesting background, Michael, because you at Cornell, you studied government. And while you were at Penn getting your medical degree, you also were getting a master's degree at Wharton. And you also have an MPH. Have you given thought to what you might try to do to convince governments, our own national government in the United States, but also international, other governments, about conducting these long-term cohort studies or these studies on rare diseases that have horrible, very burdensome symptoms?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, some legislation that's helped. So I'll get specific and then a little bit more wistful in my thinking.
Okay.
I think the Best Pharmaceuticals for Children's Act, the BPCA, and the Pediatric Research Equity Act created a nice carrot and a stick. So BPCA allowed, so if you do the study and you can prove that it works in kids, you can extend your hold on that specific product. So there's financial incentive there. And then PREA, the Pediatric Research Equity Act, created that stick that encouraged companies to do these studies to include kids when there was no reason not to include kids. So that's one way where I think legislation has used market incentives to encourage investigators and companies to develop these studies. You know, the thing is, you know, we talked about asthma. That's a 8-9 year waiting game. If you're looking at, well, is this going to improve the mental health in adults? That's 20-25 years. So I think other countries have done this well, where they have national cohorts of kids that they're following. If you can design a cohort study of kids and build in the opportunity to ask questions and add questions and follow a cohort of kids, you know, through childhood, like the National Children's Study was supposed to do, I think that's a great framework for developing these other questions and studies. You just have to be flexible, and it takes very smart and dedicated folks designing the cohorts to make it applicable so that you can add these other questions. So those are big, big, big investments. And, you know, if we're really serious about childhood health, I think that's one of the things we should invest in. And we have to a limited extent, but maybe that's something we should go all in. So some short-term successes, but I think United States National Children's Study would be great.
And Michael, you talked, obviously we've established children are not just small adults. They're not just adults reduced in size. They're at a very important stage of their development. And, you know, things can happen in childhood that will reverberate into adulthood. Does that give you any pause when you're considering putting a live biotherapeutic or a living organism into a child that might colonize, that might, you know, have an effect that won't be visible for many, many years? Or I'm talking about the opposite side now, the kind of safety side. How do you reassure yourself on that?
No, great question. So a child's gut microbiota, or an infant's gut microbiota, develops over time, and it depends on what the, you know, initial exposures are, whether it's a vaginal delivery or a C-section. But even then, there's that period, I think, for the first year or two before it's really fully established. So sure, it does give me pause when you think about introducing something that might manipulate the gut microbiota. And it's such a complicated system that you're right, we don't know what the long-term effects are. So monitoring the safety is really important. So I think there in general is a higher scrutiny for the safety of early interventions during child development, especially prenatal interventions as well too, because there's so much going on in such a limited time. And, you know, Colin, I guess I'll turn it around the other way. When I did my rotations in the neonatal intensive care unit, or even in the newborn nursery, if we were concerned about a child having an infection, we would get a blood culture, we'd maybe get a urine culture and maybe do a spinal tap. But we'd also, just to be safe, start 3 days of antibiotics. Now, that was 20 years ago, but 3 days of antibiotics for a child, that could have deleterious effects as well for a child's microbiota, but we didn't really consider that. So it does give me pause, but there's also a lot of things we do in routine clinical care that might have effects as well. And we should, if we're thinking about that in terms of probiotic or prebiotic studies, we should also be thinking about those antibiotic interventions that we do at the drop of a hat, it seems like.
I absolutely agree with that. But do you think among the pediatric community at large, are you an outlier in having faith in the ability of probiotics to influence long-term health and the potential deleterious effect of antibiotics? Or do you think most pediatricians are still prescribing antibiotics, perhaps in a way that you wouldn't agree with?
Yeah, I think there's been greater sensitivity among my colleagues about the judicious use of antibiotics, more for preventing antibiotic resistance, I think, because it is such a valuable resource. And as we lose antibiotics and they become less affected, that's going to be a problem. So I don't know if I'm an outlier. I think there is some sensitivity to the use of antibiotics. I think I'm a skeptic, but an optimist. So I think any good scientist has some skepticism. But for me, I'm an optimist in terms of what I've seen with some of the probiotic studies. So I wouldn't call myself an outlier, but a healthy skeptic with an optimistic side. How's that?
That's really good. But I assume, I just want to kind of reinforce that, parents of small children, if their pediatrician or their GP recommends an antibiotic after, that people shouldn't be too reluctant to follow that advice, I guess, so long as they're used judiciously.
Yeah, I think if it's used judiciously, and, I do think there's good evidence for example, antibiotic-associated diarrhea for the treatment of colic for certain indications where the evidence is really strong for probiotic intervention. So I think the challenge is getting the information out there and making sure people know what those recommendations and the strength of the evidence is.
Can we close on an optimistic note, Michael?
Sure.
You've raised a daughter from the little girl to now her early adulthood. What do you think about this new generation? I see these young pediatricians in training and medical students, and I'm amazed. What gives you hope about the future of medicine and future science?
I am just impressed with the people we're able to attract, work in academic medical centers and who we've attracted into the field of pediatrics. So I think folks are not only interested in giving great clinical care, but we have folks focused on research, folks focused on our educational mission, making sure the next generation of clinician scientists is even better trained. And I've also seen this growing interest in advocacy, making sure we invest in kids as much tomorrow, if not more so than today. The other change that I've seen is just the understanding about health equity and how that's important. When we make decisions about what we prioritize, if it helps address not only an important and common issue, but an issue where there's equity issues in terms of outcomes, that's gained a lot of attention too. So I think that's really promising. I think Dan and Colin, I don't know if I could get into medical school today. The students are that much more talented and that's that much more well-rounded. So I think the future is bright.
Thanks, Michael. That was fantastic. We really enjoyed talking to you. And of course, we want to thank you as well for your service to ISAP and spending so much time on the board, and wish you every success going forward. Thanks again.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for the opportunity. A lot of fun.